are now checked into Let's Talk Books Radio.
This is Stephanie Allen. I am a member of the Black Lesbian Literary Collective. I am joined by my co-director and co-host, Lauren Sherrill. And today we're talking to Leona Beasley about her amazing novel, Something Better Than Home. Welcome, Leona.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So we will just jump right in with our first question. So tell us a little bit about how you came up with the idea for this novel.
Well, coming up with the idea for the novel was relatively easy because it's loosely based on my life. Mm-hmm. But I think what I more wanted to do was write and tell a story that I hadn't seen. And that is a story that depicts a young Black lesbian protagonist mm-hmm. who knows who she is, mm-hmm. who discovers and understands she's gay, and wants to be gay, and seeks ways to act on who she is, and is, you know, more apt to, she fights for it versus allowing people to tell her she can't. And so I wanted to really create something that I hadn't ever read before.
You mentioned that Ani's story is loosely based on your story. So do you mind telling us how much of her story is actually your story?
Well, I think the thing of growing up in the South, mm-hmm. growing up in the same time period, the 1970s and to early 80s, it is the, I think what I did is the neighborhood that I grew up in is called Dixie Hills. Uh-huh. And I just sort of never seen a place like Dixie Hills either. So Dixie Hills is depicted like Dixie Hills was for me. And I think sort of how she's more like me than anything, it's the spirit of what I felt when I lived there. Sort of that, in a lot of ways, it's a sort of a love letter to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And I think that there could be people who would read it. I think especially people who might be in my family who would read it and might not feel that way. But mm-hmm. I think that you can both love a place and also desperately need to leave it so you can be all of who you're meant to be.
Right.
So I think in that way, it's absolutely like my life. And I think the other ways that I think is the spirit of the parents. Mm-hmm. So not all of it is true, but the spirit of who the parents are aligned with the spirit of who my parents were to me.
Okay. I love what you said about, you know, you can love a place and then need to leave it. I feel like the absolute same way about my hometown. I love it so mm-hmm. much, but I knew that to be my full self, I had to go somewhere else and live, you know, so I absolutely get that.
And I think that's most especially true for people who are gay and lesbian, transgender, bisexual, et cetera, because there's this way in which when you're in that place, people want to see you only as that kid that they have modeled and fostered you to be versus who you're trying to blossom and become.
Right.
Well, Leona, definitely thank you for explaining it to us because that was along the lines of my first question. But I really enjoy being able to sit with a story that was laced with such authentic characters and authentic experiences. And in chapter 5, Water Buns, you kind of introduce us into Ani's experiences with the church. And I just feel like there are some things that are just right, you know, just hitting the nail on the head from the gay choir director to the overperforming preachers. And even you kind of touched on this a little bit, like the politics of seating. When Ani was pretty much being lured through the doors of the church, meaning she was pretty much forced to accept Christ and become baptized, that right mm-hmm. there was spoken from the voice of a woman who had lived that, that had first-hand experience. But I will say another thing that hit home for me with that scene is because it happened to me as well. You wrote in the spirit of the things that you experienced. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. I think that when I wrote it, I really wanted it to, and it's still my goal to get it in the hands of people who can see themselves in it. And once I read, when I was living in California, I read excerpts of it. This is before it was a book, of Wartabon. And a woman who was, she was of the Catholic faith and from Ireland. I think she was from Ireland. She was definitely from another country. And she saw her own experience in it. And it's not even the same baptismal ritual. Mm. So it's really, but she was also gay. So it's that thing of kind of feeling and seeing mirrors of ourselves, which I think is important. And then some of the stories have been, you know, embellished for fiction, for, you know, for the story's sake. Mm-hmm. But I took most of my kernels of either full-on truths or half-truths or experiences. And then I just developed a story to tell, this story of a girl who I really just wanted to be her own sort of everyday superhero. Because she just was going to go no matter what anybody else said. And so, and in that way, she liked me and not like me, because I listened a little bit more than she did. But I felt like if given half a chance, I would be absolutely like her. And so I sort of fashioned somebody who could feel these things at a little, who could be more sort of self-directed about her gayness at a younger age than I think, and her gayness and her agency around it at a younger age than I was able to actually conjure up. I did at a young age, but it only reminded me of some of the young people that I was a young woman I went to high school with, and I saw in her that bravery to kind of be out and be, you know, a full-on tomboy, never wearing girls' clothes, mm-hmm. ever in high school, and I so admired her, and so I gave Oni some of those characteristics along with some of my own.
I really love that she's such a tomboy from day one, you know, and we know that she's a girl, she's absolutely okay with that, but she's also very, very comfortable with her masculine side. And so mm-hmm. the question that was, you know, why did you decide to characterize her that way? And then you just answered that question. So, but I think that was one of the things I really loved about this, that she was so sure about who she was, even as such a little bitty girl, you know. And I think that so many of us that read this were like, oh my God, I wish we could have been like that. I wish I could have been like that when I was that little. I wish I could have known or could have said it or could have expressed it in whatever way it was I could have at the time. So I think this is one of the things that's so wonderful about this book, is that it does give us a way to think about, you know, how this story might impact young girls who are thinking about who they are right now, you know, and how they can become mm-hmm. more of themselves, mm-hmm. you know, at an earlier age, because most of us, well, at least most folks I know, came out as adults. Mm-hmm. I know very few mm-hmm. people were out when I was in school, and I always envied the one or two girls that I knew, you know, because right. I knew that, you know, how do they live? You know, how are they getting away with it, you know? And so I think, if you're growing up in the South, you know, it's something that you're getting away with, right? You know, so I think mm-hmm. that was one of the things that I just loved about, you know, her just brazenness in some ways, you know, that she was able to say, hey, this is who I am. I want to be a king. I don't want to be queen. I don't want to be a princess, you know. One of the other things that's kind of related to that, though, was what you said about, you know, in your own personal experience, you were a little more, and I'll just use the word obedient, but one of the things that Oni was not, you know, was she wasn't easily directed, you know, by her parents or by her teachers, anybody, you know. Mm-hmm. As I read this, from a parent's perspective, I was like, girl, you know, sometimes you just got to listen, you know, you know. So I do think that, you know, for me was a point where I was a little conflicted, because I wanted her to have her agency, but I also know that she got in a lot of trouble that could have been avoided. She just paid attention to her mama just a little bit.
I hear that. But I think in literature, there's a long tradition of most especially little boys. I mean, it makes me think of Huck Finn, or who are allowed to sort of, well, people are trying to tell them what they should and shouldn't do. They go on these adventures, and they face grave danger, mm-hmm. and, you know, in some ways worse than Oni, mm-hmm. and they come out okay. I think that they're just some kids who are like that, and it was a lot of fun to write that, mm-hmm. to be honest with you, because it's sort of, all of us dream of being rebellious and, mm-hmm. and surviving it, and some people actually do, but I think that there are a lot of characters in literature who do that, but they happen to, by and large, be boys, and almost always white boys.
Right.
So I agree. So I think that this was one of those times that it was, as I say, both fun and I feel like she exists. It's just because I didn't know her, or just because somebody else didn't know her, doesn't mean she didn't exist in some small town somewhere in the United States, in the southern United States at that.
Right.
So, and I absolutely did see inflections of it in young women that I knew at that time in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And after spending some years teaching, and this is years later, but I have had students, when I lived in California, I taught a preschool and early grade ages.
Mm-hmm.
And I had little girls who, you know, they weren't necessarily trying to transition, but they themselves only wore boy clothes. They had little girlfriends, and they were 3, 4, and 5, and it was the cutest thing. So all these things, you know, all the experiences. I think that this is how stories get told. All mm-hmm. those experiences that you've lived, if you've lived a life at whatever point you're now writing, you just fold it into the characters that you're writing, and it is also why I had to call it a novel and not a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel as an author, you have that free license to create all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's why I'm so drawn to sci-fi and speculative fiction, because then you can even be a little more, you know, even a little more sort of out of the norm, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but I think that there's so many kids. Like, look at my 4-year-old. Now, this is, of course, he's growing up now, and I was growing up in the 70s. But he thinks he knows everything. It is amazing. Like, my God, how is it that you know everything? And he'll ask me a question. I'll give him the answer. Then he tells me, no, that's not the answer. And I tell him all the time, honey, if you have the answer, there's no need for you to ask me for the answer. You already have it. So, you know, so I just kind of feel like, but I think also, if you think about how the novel is set up, we have privy into what's going on in her mind more so than what she is actually doing. There are things that she does. The thing is that she's still going to school. She's still doing her work.
Mm-hmm.
She gets accepted in college. So she's following a lot of rules.
Right.
And she's hiding a lot of stuff too. So she has two worlds. She has sort of her gay friends. They go off and explore. And that's all hidden from her parents.
Right.
Her parents know nothing about that. Mm-hmm. And so she's not listening, but she's also keeping it covert, which I think is what a lot of children do. They just always have, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I also feel like it's a mark of a leader in a lot of ways. And if it can be guided somehow, I think kids do go out on quests and you know, sort of go on their own little journeys in the small ways that they do them. And I know that our son's not gonna completely listen to me, but what I am gonna do is give him the tools, which I think my mother did do for me in a lot of ways. And so, so here's the story.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, of course, from a parent's perspective, she's a nightmare. And so, you know, and it depends on the parent, right? So some parents are a little more, you know, sort of loosey goosey with it, and they're sort of like, you know, well, I feel like this kid, I'm going to give this kid the tools they need and they're going to find their way. And other parents are more like, no, you must absolutely do it the way I want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her parents were more, I mean, aside from the corporal punishment stuff, which is horrible and is not something I advocate at all. But I think that in a way they allowed her to go do stuff because they could have, like, you know, for instance, her father teaching her to drive. He could have never taught her to drive. They couldn't have allowed her to have a car, and she could have just stayed at home all the time in her bedroom dreaming about girls.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas she actually got a chance to get in the car, and you know, she wasn't picking the best girls, but she had something to pick from, you know what I mean? So, you know, it's all those things. So she was allowed a lot of freedom that some parents don't actually allow kids to have.
I want to go back to some of the stuff we just said in the conversation because—
Absolutely.
There were some parts of this story that I feel like had a lot of timeless things,
mm-hmm.
meaning, for example, y'all were just talking about how, you know, when we were in high school or our experiences, you know, if we could have been that brave at that point in time in our lives. And it just makes me think, you know, what's the experience of teenagers now? But there was one thing in particular, and let me go to my notes. So it was chapter 8, which is titled Pink Pig. And like you said, Liana, a lot of the things that Ani experienced were adventures. And I noted for myself that this chapter was full of adventures. But when you get to the third paragraph in that chapter, something happens that I just absolutely did not see coming. And Ani is in the girls' restroom. She's sitting in the stall sipping Mac about 2020. And I'm going to read a part of that. It says, alcohol rushed to my brain, and in seconds, I was heated up. Afterwards, I felt loose and unfettered by Mama's constant input on how I acted, dressed, where I was going, and who would be there. Between the drops of wine, I found solace. Brief, bombless moment of liquid calm. And I just was sitting there thinking at this point, oh no, please, I hope you're not going there. I hope you're not going there, because we know like the perils of being a teenager. And Ani was definitely a character who was being, like you said, she had like these two worlds, one where she could be herself and one where she was, you know, kind of met with a lot of opposition. And I was just like, oh my God, Leona, I just hope you're not going to open the floodgates into like her, you know, not being able to cope with all these things. Yeah. But anyway, I don't have a question. I just wanted to talk about it.
But then you, but then you were okay that she, because I think, see, here's the other thing too. When I was coming along, the drinking age was 18. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kids, you know, I went to parties where there was alcohol, and it shouldn't have been there, but it was. And people, you know, people had spiked punch, and I had a friend in high school who, you know, we would bring. Well, I actually didn't have access to it at our house, but we would figure out how to bring alcoholic beverages mixed in something in Tupperware cups. It is ridiculous, but it did happen. And so, you know, it's like, so I'm telling the story of what young people do.
Right.
And, you know, she wasn't on crack, you know, and right. Not, she should be. But you know what I mean? I think that this is what young people do. Yeah. And you know, and I think it's so interesting that to carry it in a Tupperware cup, because it's the kind of thing that, you know, you can carry something in a Tupperware cup to school as your lunch. And nobody's going to think about any, it, you know, twice about it. And it can be a color and, you know, and it's diluted and here we are.
That definitely happens a lot. And I can't say one thing I appreciate about like YA is that you get the lessons learned. And I definitely appreciate this part because although Ani had the opportunity to kind of, you know, cope in a not so healthy way, she found her way through it. You know, there were definitely some sticky parts of the story where you just, the reader just kept feeling like, you know, she could have really hit moments of despair where it could have like really changed the trajectory of her life, you know, for a not so good way. But that one moment I was reading, I'm like, oh my God, like I don't want her to.
Did you think it was gonna? This was like the beginning of her becoming an alcoholic.
Yeah, dependency for sure. But you allow the character to find resolution in her journey.
Well, you know, and I think that, you know, especially being a young adult and being out in my 20s. There was so much drinking. There was a bar in the Bay Area that was called Maud's, and it was pretty famous. Uh-huh. And it was just, and years later, they did a documentary about just, you know, at some point in the 80s, a lot of women who had been drinking in the 70s, and these will be people older than me and older than you all. They got on the clean and sober tip. But I think that drinking has been a big part of gay life. Mm-hmm. And because it has been a coping. And I, you know, but as I said before, I think that I was really sprinkling what I thought was true to who she was. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I've had my times where I drink, but I'm not a drinker. Like, I'm not going to go, and I'm not an alcoholic. I like to have my wine and, you know, I can have a drink. But I think when I was younger, I drank a little bit more than I do now. And I know I drank more before I came out, before I came out officially, like to everybody. I was already out to myself. And so I think that those stories, it's the thing of seeking the truth. Like, you know, I think as Hemingway talks about the bullshit barometer, And so it just it just rings true that any young person is going to be experimenting with something, some substance. And it's unfortunate, but it is true. And then what the hope is that they do what they do and they're able to come out of that and not stay stuck in and not swirl into some deep, dark pool of despair and can't bring themselves and keep moving on with their life, you know? I think that that's the trick about even college, when people are allowed to first have that first taste of freedom. That's why it's actually, I think, good to allow kids to have some freedom in high school, because now they are just like unsupervised altogether. And what will they do? You don't want them to spend their entire time drinking bottles of wine instead of going to class.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I remember now. Now, I have to be honest, I disagree with you, because I never drank when I was in high school. I never did. But when I graduated, I remember I looked older than my friends, so I was always a person to go in the liquor store and buy the liquor, because nobody would card me, which is hilarious when I think about it now. But no doubt, you know, Boone's Farm, Mad Dog 2020, and Brass Monkey were drinking, and so I know, Leon, you probably know those names, but that's what people were drinking.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. You know that, and even when I first came out, we didn't really have a real gay bar. Well, we had a gay bar, but it was really white and it was really male focused. You know, in the town I grew up in, mm-hmm. I drank at home though. So that was the thing to do. And I think part of it is, you know, folks coping with, you know, whatever they're dealing with. And then secondly, where else do you go? What else do you do? If there's nothing to do or no places where you feel safe, then alcohol and having a drink is a way to kind of entertain yourself. And I think that's also part of the culture that I know I grew up with, you know, in terms of just coming out that, you know, even if we didn't go to anybody's bar, we were certainly sitting at somebody's house and somebody had some wine or had something or whatever, somebody made some drinks. And that's exactly what people did, you know. So I agree with that. You know, I think it's when you think about it now, it's a little sad, because I think that that's, you know, that's all we had to do. You know, I know that we have more now, even though we've got some stuff going on. But no doubt, you know, lots of folks got in trouble with that, you know.
Yeah.
I know that there were other folks that I remember, you know, then you said crack. And I remember people would smoke a lot of weed, and people smoke weed with crack in it. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. And I just remember feeling like a nut, because I didn't realize people did that until I found out somebody did, you know. So I think that, you know, it depends on where you are, too, in terms of, you know, what I won't say is acceptable, but just in terms of what's common in your area, you know. And I remember the first time I heard about somebody smoking, you know, weed, you know, with something laced in it, I was in my late 20s, you know. But, you know, but that was something that people were doing, you know, in that small Black gay community, you know. So, you know, those folks were outliers on some level, but there's no doubt that there's lots of addiction and lots of other kinds of issues going on with people who, you know, haven't figured out how to make peace, you know, with themselves on some level, you know. So, you know, I appreciated this, because I know that there were kids in high school when I was coming up, you know, who were drinking in the bathroom. That was just what they were doing.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and even smoking pot, smoking pot
on the back of the school bus. Yeah,
absolutely. And going to class, smelling like pot. It's like, wow, you really, you know, you got a lot of nerve. I mean, you're gonna smoke some pot. Perhaps you should wait till, you know, not on the premises,
Right.
Yeah,
they were both.
But I mean, I need kids to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, here's what I want to just really quick thing about drinking. I really feel like drinking is Americana. It's like an American institution, you know, and some of it may stem from prohibition. I don't know. But, like, even if you're not gay, high schoolers drink. And I think it's the altered mindset that people want to have. And it's like, you know, I'm not in school now. We're just doing our things. Even in big cities where there's lots of things to do.
Right.
Kids still get together and they have lots of things to do. And sometimes the more money they have, the worse it is. Because then they can get high level drugs involved in this situation beyond just beer or some wine. So I think that it really is an American thing. And then the unfortunate side of fallout, it can be that you're now drinking it at such a young age. And it, you know, it's touching on, if you have it in your family, it may begin to take you on a journey that you, you're not ready for. But that's not our only story. And it's certainly not my story. It's certainly not her or my story.
Right.
But either of our stories. But I do think it's part of high school culture.
I agree. I mean, what was the famous movie, American Graffiti? I mean, that's what they were doing in the right?
That's all they were doing. Right? You know, and so drag racing.
Yeah, exactly. Which also happens in your novel, right? But yeah, so I think it's a bit of a rite of passage, like going to the prom or, you know, your first kiss or whatever. I think that that's a part of, like you said, American culture in some way. It's kind of strange when you think about it that way, but that's absolutely what it is, that this is something that most people end up doing at some point during their teen or later teen or early, you know, college years, because it's just a part of what people are doing, you know. So I absolutely do.
My first take on having, my first time having something to drink was actually beer. I have never liked beer. The first time I had it, I didn't like it. The second time I had it, I didn't like it. It's not something I drink. And every now and again, I'll be somewhere, and, you know, they're well-crafted now. And they almost like, you know, it's almost like you can go to like a nice wine bar, you can go to a nice beer craft, and you can try different ones. I have a little taste, but I don't like beer. I'm just not a beer drinker. So, you know, but what if my taste buds, you know, the challenge is, what if my taste buds were the ones that really loved it and I couldn't stop and, you know, there you go. But yeah, so I think it's, yeah, so that's it.
And it was cheap too. It was cheap. That was the other thing.
Yes. And because 18 at that time, because 18 was the age limit, and was the age that you could go purchase alcohol, you could always get somebody who's not that much older than you can go get it. So older brothers and sisters or what, cousins, that kind of thing, they can go in and get it for you.
Yeah.
Or in our case, or in the case of this one of the stories, they solicit a drunk that's standing outside.
Right.
You know, I think here's the thing too that I love about having been able to write this story. It's just the really sort of ridiculous stuff teenagers and young people do. Like, it's just ridiculous, but they do it, and it's funny. And, you know, it can be sad, but it's funny too in a way, because we're all really lucky that we're here. I'm sure everybody has a story where they could say, I could have been gone if it just switched one way or the other. I could like not be here. I think everybody has that story. So it's the I also really like to find the humor in it, because it was just, it's just really, really ridiculous to stand outside and, you know, solicit some strange man who could rob you, do anything to you, you know, take your money for sure, but do something to you. And, you know, but I would like to say I never met a pimp, but I just really want to write that story about a pimp, because I think it was interesting. But here's where the pimp story came from.
Okay.
When I was living, or the first time we lived in New York, who is my now wife, but she was my girlfriend then, we were in the West Village. And we lived in Brooklyn. We lived in Fort Greene. This was before Fort Greene was she. This is when Fort Greene was still slightly, it was some nice parts, but it was some edgy parts. And we lived in at the border. So anyway, but it has nothing to do with Fort Greene, but that's where we lived. We were in the West Village, and we had a little bitty, you know, a sort of beat up car that we had. And so she said, I'm going to go in and I'm going to get some hors d'oeuvres. We're going to go look at a movie. I'm going to get some hors d'oeuvres, get some snacks. And I went to go get whatever I went to go get. And she said, meet me here on the corner. And this was before, this was like the late 90s. So it was before you really use cell phones all the time.
Okay.
And so literally she was standing on this corner in the West Village and waiting for me. And I was on a whole nother corner in the car waiting for her. Somehow we got our corner switched, and it took us about 30 minutes to find each other. But while she was standing there, this guy approached her, and his name was Black Magic. This is what he told her. And he's telling her that, you know, now we are fully grown people. I mean, I think she's in her late 20s at this point, and I'm in my 30s.
Okay.
And he's you know, telling her that, you know, did she have anywhere to live, and did she need some help, and he could help her. And I'm just like, really? I mean, when we got back together, this is the story that she told, and it just always sort of stayed in my mind. And that's the thing of telling stories. And that's why I love fiction. You can just pull it from, you know, it's almost right. Like you just sort of snatch it out of the sky, because it's in the sky of your brain, and you just pull it down and you use it when you need to use it. And when I decide that Oni is gonna go running away, you know, for that brief time that she was running away, she would go absolutely to the Krispy Kreme because it was one of the few things that was open 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And it would have to be a pimp there who sees this girl by herself who wants to, you know, tell her he can give her the life she, you know, always wanted or whatever. And, you know, only he's not going to go anywhere with anybody.
Right.
You know, and that's just all there is too. But yeah, so I just wanted to tell that little part of the story.
That's awesome, though. I love that because it absolutely seems so real. I would not doubt that at all, you know, in terms of just the reality of it happening for real, for real. And then also, you know, you coming up with the idea for Oni's, you know, scene, you know, based on what had happened, because we know that there are men who do that. They wait at bus stops and at corners and at, you know, restaurants. And I can only imagine in Atlanta, it might have been a Waffle House, you know, waiting for women, you know, who seem to be, you know, in a little bit of trouble. And then here they are trying to pick them up as prostitutes. So, so make them into a prostitute. So that's really, I really like the origin story. That's great.
So, Yana, before we wrap up, I want to shift gears for a minute. It's 2018, and this year I have vowed to myself that I'm going to be more mindful about the writing process, and I think it's just a great opportunity to talk to another writer and to ask you. First, tell the listeners, was this your first novel?
Yes.
Okay. So, what surprised you the most about writing, the whole process of writing your first novel?
I think the thing that I was most surprised about is what I've heard other writers say, and I really didn't believe them, is the process is where the joy is. Like the actual doing is where the joy is. And it's not that you're not happy when you finish, but it's really good to understand it's great to embrace the process. Mm-hmm. And I didn't believe that for a long time. And I think, so that's one thing. I think the other thing is I also didn't believe that, but I came to understand, to love the process. So the second thing is I think I didn't believe that there was value in stopping and doing something else. So collecting some other information, writing something else, going to a movie, going to a museum, taking a walk. I originally believed, especially when I was in graduate school, you just have to keep going and, you know, and I pushed myself. But my writing got better when I allowed myself to take breaks. And by breaks, I mean, you know, go on an artist date, go meet with a friend, but just take some time away from the story. Mm-hmm. I still have a hard time with that because I get very upset that I can't right now. My brain, it's not that, because I don't feel like I will ever have writer's block, but I feel like I have writer's focus, you know? So sometimes I'm just not really able to focus on it. And I get so upset about it. And I give myself a hard time, and it takes a couple of weeks sometimes to get my, but then what happens is if I just allow myself to, you know, go see some movies, go read some books, do some research. That's why I don't like real cold weather, because I love being outside and it's actually too cold to be outside. Mm-hmm. The last thing I want to say about writing, I think the thing is, it's just important to try to make yourself do it. Even if it's just for short periods of time, just to continue to make yourself do it and to read as much as you can. I know Stephanie will agree with that.
Absolutely. If you're not reading, you shouldn't be writing. That's my motto.
Yeah, you should always have books, be surrounded by books and have your head in it at some point.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I would like to say here and now on the record so it can become a fact, I want to move back to the South.
Not okay. Yet, buddy. Y'all heard live on this recording. She's coming back.
I really do, because I want to be able to be outside year round. Mm-hmm. It's not even the snow, but sometimes it's just so cold. You know, like a couple of weeks ago, I went to go for a walk and it was so cold, I literally could not stay outside more than 20 minutes.
Thank you for sharing that about your writing process. I definitely want to encourage us, you know, Black lesbian writers, to definitely have more conversations about the work. You know, like you said, the whole process and just being able to love it and share and just talk about it and, you know, to grow in it as well. So I really appreciate that. So before we end, let everyone know where they can find you online.
Find me online at leonabeasley.com. My email address is leona@leonabeasley.com. And you can also find me on Instagram at Leona B's Writer.
Well, Leona, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today about Something Better Than Home. And I wish you the best in your writing journey.
Thank you.